You're listening to Radio Primavera Sound, proudly presented by Cupra.
Hello and welcome to Radio Primavera Sound. Just a few weeks ago, I spoke to the American indie legend Dean Wareham. Yes, ex-Galaxy 500 and Luna, and a brilliant solo artist ahead of his Barcelona gig, which is on April the 20th. And we spoke about his new album, That's the Price of Loving Me. We talked about singing in German, some book recommendations. We talked about Mary Poppins. We talked about LA. We talked about lots of things. I really hope you enjoy the interview.
I'm in Los Angeles, at home in Los Angeles, where it poured with rain all night. That's it. Rain here. It does rain.
It's been a bit like that in Barcelona recently, actually.
Oh, good. I know you need it.
Oh, God. Yeah. We had like this.
Is that over?
We had such a horrible drought last year that it's because I'm from Scotland, I always used to hate it when it was raining. And my wife, who's from here, was like, no, we need the rain. And I was never convinced until last year. And then I was sort of looking at the weather app, and anytime that it was raining, I was like, oh, this is brilliant. You know, it's good. Actually, it's interesting you're in Los Angeles because I really love the video for That's the Price of Loving Me. I was going to get into that, but why not? And that's all Los Angeles, isn't it?
Yeah, that's shot in, I live in Echo Park. That's just, that's the lake. You see that lake in so many shots of LA. You know, they show the Hollywood sign. They'll often show that lake. It's just a thing. It's a man-made lake, pretty close to the center of the city. That video is kind of cinema verite, just wandering around, going to a local bookshop. We got here in Echo Park, we've got four bookshops. It's crazy. people say people don't read here.
Well, I was gonna come to this later, but in the video for the song, you go to a bookshop and you buy Thomas Mann's Death in Venice, I think.
Yes.
And later, you're reading another book, which I don't think
I'm reading the Hundred Years War on Palestine, or I think it's called.
Yes, yeah.
Which is really good. It was a bestseller here. It's really good. Just a history of the last 100 years, just from their perspective, you know, the perspective of people, you know, and you know, some of the blame goes to them, but they've just long been disorganized. But right from, you know, from around World War I, they're angry, like, hey, can we have a state too? And they would just always just push aside, like, no, not for you.
Anyway, I was good.
And the Thomas Mann, my book, I brought along to them, and I bought it because there's a story in there I like Tonio Kruger, which is one of his early stories when he was about 25, and it's a short story about an artist or a writer, I think, who goes back to visit his hometown, and he's quite famous, but nobody recognized him. In fact, they tried to arrest him. I think he's what he's doing. And his friend in the story calls him a bourgeois monkey. And that's why I took that phrase and wrote a song around it. And I read that story in high school in my German class. But I come back to it every once in a while.
Well, you see, this is all coming together, because I want to ask you about German, because obviously you cover Nico on the new album, Reich der Trauma. How much German do you speak?
My German's pretty bad now. I have a good accent. Sometimes I think whenever I do a song, people are like, wow, do you really speak German? My vocabulary has left me. But I don't know. I mean, I can get around. When I go to Germany, I can order in restaurants. I can get around a little bit. And it would probably come back if I just spent a few months. But I did. I studied it in high school. I studied it at university. And then I lived there for about a year. So, but my German teacher in high school, for the first week, I remember, she wouldn't let us even learn any words. She just had to sit there doing vowels, like, I'm thankful for that, actually. Because, you know, it's something that we all struggle with a new language.
Well, I was going to say, like, you, Nico is not an easy artist to cover. How did that come about?
Somehow I was on YouTube and found that song. It's not on a Nico album. It was written by her guitar player, Lutz Graf Ulbrich, I think his name is. And he toured with her a lot in the 80s. And so it's on his solo album, but Nico does it. You can find it on YouTube, but I just heard that. I was like, wow, this is a really beautiful Nico song that no one has ever heard, I don't think.
Yeah. I hadn't heard it.
Yeah. So there you go.
But how do you go about, like, copying that Nico voice? Because Nico is going to sound, probably going to sound like a parody.
Yeah, well, I guess I didn't try to sing like her. She's got a very unique voice, obviously. I've been reading this new book about the Velvet Underground that I'm supposed to write an introduction for, and I just reading the early section on Nico when she puts out her first single, I'm Not Saying, on Andrew Luke Oldham's immediate label in England. And the press had just savaged her. They're just like, she can't sing. This person's all, you know. And yeah, I guess on one level, she can't sing. But on the other level, she's a captivating and unique singer, you know. So people would die to be that unique. I mean, same if I would say of Marlene Dietrich. Sure, she can't sing, but she's a brilliant musician.
Have you read Songs They Don't Play on the Radio, the book about Nico in Manchester?
I don't think I've read that. No, I read something that went into her years in Manchester, but maybe that was a different one. Who wrote Songs They Don't Play on the Radio?
So it's Songs They Never Play on the Radio. It was written by, I've just got it here. It was written by James Young, who
yes,
was...
Yes, I have read that. I have read that, yeah.
That's an amazing book. I absolutely love that book.
Yeah.
Actually, I was going to ask, what with the books in the video, recommend us a book not that isn't your own.
What? Recommend you a book? Well, the 100 Years War in Palestine, I recommend that. Train Dreams by Dennis Johnson. That's a short one by Dennis Johnson. It's kind of a Western a little bit, but True Grit. Have you ever read True Grit?
No.
I think I hadn't read it, and people think of it and they think of the film. Mm-hmm. And I think the book when it came out was hailed as a classic, but then once it gets turned into a John Wayne film, people are just like, oh, it's that John Wayne film. But it's really, now it's twice been made into a movie. But the language is great. It's told from the perspective of this 13-year-old girl who hires someone to avenge her death.
Sorry, I've gone all over the place. So, I mean, getting your new album, which is out on March the 28th, That's the Price of Loving Me. It's a lovely album.
Thank you.
I know that the title for the album comes from the song of the same title. But I was wondering, like, what made you call the album that? And I wondered if, and sorry to get slightly armchair psychoanalyst on this, if this is something like a message in a way to your fans.
Or is it a message to my wife? I think that's sort of more how it's intended. And I was thinking of my own just sort of life on the road. But actually also, like, the first verse, I sort of written for my friend Kiko, who's this crazy Italian tour manager. Eccentric, let's say. He passed away a couple of years ago. And so he drives the Sprinter van. Anyway, Pico had moved from Italy to Manchester in the 90s because he wanted to meet Tony Wilson, and he was fascinated by him. And he got to do that. And he was a pharmacist. But then they took his license away from him for some indiscretions. He became a tour manager, and he did several tours for us and for Mogwai, who's close with Mogwai, super furry animals, and Gruff Reese. Everybody knew him. Anyway, he died under mysterious circumstances a couple of years ago. And the life on the road was like last place I saw him actually was Glasgow at the end of a tour over there. As we said goodbye to him, he drove the van off from the hotel. And we're starting our tour at the exact same, in Glasgow, and I'm staying at the same hotel. I think I'm trying to make myself cry. Yeah, so I guess maybe it's just, I don't know. It's a slightly humorous song too, just about like I said, about life on the road. Well, sometimes, or the perils of pursuing a career in the arts.
And you worked with Kramer on the record for the first time since 1990.
Yes.
How did that happen?
We've stayed in touch. I mean, we drifted apart in the 90s, but during the pandemic, he mixed one song for Britta and I. We did a cover of The Carnival Is Over by The Seekers. I don't know if you know that song. And he mixed it and did a really nice job. And then he would always remind me, it's crazy we haven't made a record since then. And I just, at some point, it dawned on me. Well, maybe after Kiko passed away, actually. I was kind of like, oh, people, we're not here forever, are we? And because I just kept saying, yeah, we'll do that record. We'll do that sometime. And this now I just finally was like, all right, I will book some studio time, which is the only thing that makes me make a record. I'm not someone who has a routine of writing songs every day. It's only if I book studio time. Because I know it will be embarrassing to show up without any songs, and expensive, and a waste of money. Kramer lives in Asheville, North Carolina. He flew out, came out here to Los Angeles. So it was made here. It was made quickly. He likes to work quickly. A little more time perhaps than not much actually than we spent on Galaxy 500 records. So it's just like one or two take, that's it.
How do you feel about working that way? I mean, you said he prefers two takes to 20. Do you like that, or is there a part of you that's just like, no, but the next take could be
but I could really get the solo good. I'm fine, but I mean, I think the results were good. So, I mean, there were a few times I was like, oh, I don't know, I think I should spend some more time on this solo, but you can spend a lot of time trying to perfect a guitar solo and just kind of getting further and further away from something interesting, actually. And his approach. I offered to send him demos of the songs. He's like, no, I don't want to hear the demos. Because if I hear the demos and I listen to them, I'm familiar with the songs, then my ideas will be less interesting than if it's just in the studio, what pops into my head right then is better than. So I don't know. Either he just didn't have time for the demos or he's right.
Do you think more bands could sort of benefit from that approach, the sort of two takes?
Well, I think when you're young, you do. That's what you do. You just go in, you do something really quickly. Mm. And then the longer a band is together, the more drawn out it gets. And then you go into the studio and you'll spend time avoiding work, just procrastinating, just arguing over what guitar to use here or what amp to use here. And yeah, literally avoiding the work. But I don't know. Depends on your budget. I came across some clip of Brian Eno talking the other day, and he was saying things that make a good record: a limited budget and a short time to operate in. He's like, that's what makes a good record. And this is someone who's made records that take 18 months to make, you know, with U2. So he's seen that, how they come in and just, you know, they stand there and play chords, and he points to chord charts and they play this, play that. And it's just like, it's no way to write a song, really, is it? But I should, of course, I shouldn't advise them because they're playing the Enorma Dome and I'm not.
I'd like to see you play that big place in Las Vegas, though. The it looks like an amazing place.
What's it called again? I can't even remember. The Sphere?
Yeah. So, I mean, was it like sort of quite easy to get back to your working relationship with Crane? Was it just like the magic's back? And
it was easy because because he actually takes charge in the studio, and it's just, which is actually nice too. There's a joke about producers and screwing in a light. How many producers does it take to screw in a light bulb? I don't know. What do you think? Okay, coming back to the thing where you can just sort of just talk and talk, but he's just like, he's very quick at arranging, and he's got the arrangements in his head quickly. It was odd to sit there and look through the room and see Kramer out there. Like I said, I haven't worked with in 33 years or so.
How many roadies does it take to screw in a light bulb?
I don't know.
One, two.
Ein, zwei in German.
So that was a terrible joke, but I couldn't resist
that's
it.
That's good.
Do you, this is an obvious question, I suppose, but working again with Kramer, so does the new album kind of remind you a bit of the work you did back then, or...?
Maybe on a song or two, like Dear Betty Baby or New World Julie, those sound a bit like Galaxy 500. But I mean the one like the first thing he said was, I was like, oh, I'm gonna have my friend Derek come and play guitar too. And he was like, no. He's like, all the guitars will be played by you. I was like, all right, okay, I'll go along with that. And so maybe that was a smart decision, and it was it's a little more challenging for me. But I know how to do it, and he knows I've done it before, so he knows I can do it. So, and I think he's good at dialing in, helping dial in my guitar sounds and featuring them. So,
why didn't he want you to get someone else in to play guitar?
Maybe because in Galaxy 500, he's just, maybe he likes my guitar playing, I guess. I hope that's the answer.
I think that maybe it's because it was recorded in that way, but it sounds like carefree or easy. I kind of mean that, but I mean that in a good way, if you know what I mean. It doesn't sound good. Yeah. It sounds like an easy record.
Well, it was made. It was all kind of carefree, and it was all pretty easy. So, I mean, it was only 6 days. The studio was fantastic. It actually sounds a little slicker than Galaxy 500 records, and I think that's because the studio was super nice and the engineer was great. And a lot of people have studios in their homes in LA, and that's sort of what this was, but it's fantastic equipment. And the guy had it's called Lucy's Meat Market, and the guy has a drum kit all set up and mic'd and ready to go, which is fantastic, because usually you pull into a studio and you spend like 6 hours just going like boom, 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 checking the drums, setting them up, and then it's sort of late afternoon before you're even ready to play a note. But we were recording within half an hour getting there.
And I think I read that Serge Gainsbourg was a big influence on the record, right?
I stole a couple of chord progressions from Serge Gainsbourg. I did do that. That's The Price of Loving Me. And We're Not Finished Yet. Change the keys. You wouldn't recognize it. And to be honest, Gainsbourg was a total thief himself. I don't know if you've... You know his song New York, New York, USA.
Yes, which was someone else's song, right, or something?
It's Ola Tunji or something. I forget. It was like a record that was kind of a hit, with African drums, and he basically took the track and just wrote his own lyrics over it, and I just got away with not crediting them.
And he used to, I think, sort of lift classical chord sequences.
Yes.
What do you love about Serge Gainsbourg?
My French isn't good enough to fully appreciate the lyrics, which everyone say is just that he's this amazing. I mean, I guess I get some of it. He's sort of, I mean, like say Lee Hazelwood. I say like Ginsberg is a great producer, great songwriter. He's a little sleazier than Hazelwood, and a great, you know, another one of these singers who's not a real singer. Both of them, actually, both of them, like Hazelwood talks his way through songs. So does Serge Gainsbourg. He got frightened out of performing live because his early reviews were cruel to him. They're like, this guy doesn't belong on stage. So he didn't get on stage all through the 60s. It was only in the 70s he started. Yeah, or maybe even 80s. With that reggae record, he really went out on the road.
I was going to say, with Nico and with Serge Gainsbourg, it's kind of the European canon, isn't it? As David.
Yeah. Knows. Well, there's others, but yeah. Well, of course, Nico's a songwriter too. Not as clever, but she's more difficult to listen to.
Another thing I really love about the record is Gabe Knowles' cello.
Oh yeah,
beautiful sound. How did that happen?
I met him, Gabe, at a show. Brett and I were playing a couple songs with Harper Simon, and Gabe was playing bass and cello. Actually, bass is his main instrument, I think. And I told him I was doing a record with Kramer, and he was like, "Oh, I've got to be there for that. I have to be there." He came to the studio and had not heard the songs, but he was there about 4 hours, and he laid down, put down four-part cello arrangements on the spot. It was fun to watch him and Kramer because I don't know, they operate on a different musical level than I do. I couldn't do stuff like just, but to watch them arranging it together and doing it so quickly, and then Gabe's like, "Oh, I also brought my bass harmonica. Can I play that on at the end of You Are the Ones I Had to Betray?" And then Kramer's like, "Well, let's do another song." And Gabe's like, "No, I need to stop. I need to talk to you now." And then he's like, "Wait, what is it?" And then he told this long story of how when he was a teenager, his older brother had given him this low record that Kramer produced, and how that it changed his life, and that what led to him becoming a musician. And then by the end of it, she started to cry, and it was actually like, so it was an interesting afternoon in the studio. But yeah. He completely transformed a couple of songs. Let me get a drink of water. Hold on. And again, I think, you know, and you have to be open to someone transforming your songs. I mean, I wasn't sure with that song. You Were the Ones I Had to Betray. I wasn't sure, like, is this going to work out or not? But if you're open to something happening in the studio and you don't fight it, and then you're not like, "No, this doesn't sound like my demo at all," and get interesting results.
And I mean, it became, for me anyway, one of the best songs on the record. And given that it was a single, I presume it's one of the ones you're happiest with.
Yeah. Well, it's immediate. It hits you immediately, and it hits you with the cellos, and it's. You know, what a string instrument, they make you sound smarter than you are, perhaps.
And again, the video for that is amazing, inspired by Mary Poppins, I believe.
Yes. She was like that scene in Mary Poppins where they cross into an animated chalk world and start dancing in it. She was like, Sylvie Lake. She was like, "That's what I want to do with this."
It looked a lot of fun.
Yeah, it didn't take us long. She had a little trampoline for us to jump up and some stairs. She just had us doing these weird activities, and I was like, "What is this?" I had no idea, but that she went away and did all the work herself. But I'm glad you like it.
So you basically did some random stuff and then came back one day and you're bouncing on the drums and things like that.
Yes, yes.
That's amazing.
Yeah. Shot on an old TV tube camera too, so it's got that sort of like late 60s or 70s look to it, probably early 70s when the color when color ones came in.
No, it looks lovely. It looks the whole
thing. Yeah.
You're doing a big tour around the new record, including, I should say, playing Boston on April the 20th. Do you still enjoy touring?
It's funny, I was thinking about this last night. As the tour approaches, like, there's a certain amount of dread, I have to say. I'm just like, oh, shit. Look at all these fucking tour dates I've booked. I mean, man, like, and my agent has started, it starts in Glasgow, and got 8 shows in a row, and I'm like, I'm not 25 years old anymore. At least it's short distances, but, you know. But then once I get there, it's fun, you know. It's not fun all the time. It can be grueling too.
But no nights off. 8 shows with no nights off.
Yes.
Wow. You must have, what hints do you have for a better tour? What have you learned? What hints do you have for a better tour?
Well, don't go out after the show. I think I've kind of learned that now, because there's always, I'm on tour, there's always people and they come along and they're just there for the night and they're like, come on, I got my drink, come on, what's wrong with you? And I'm just like, no, because I'm doing 8 shows in a row and I can't go to a loud bar and start like shouting like and the talking. It's just like doesn't work. So, yeah, just to prioritize sleep and try and get like a 5-minute nap in at sound check.
Well, look, thank you so much for taking this time. Right. I really appreciate it.
I will look for your email. All right.
And a very nice, enjoy the tour. Enjoy 8 nights in Glasgow.
All right. Bye.
Bye.